Betty Friedan, Washington, D.C., April 1997. Introduction to the 10th Anniversary Edition. It is a decade now since the publication of The Feminine Mystique, and until I started writing the book, I wasn't even conscious of the woman problem. Locked as we all were then in that mystique, which kept us passive and apart, and kept us from seeing our real problems and possibilities, I, like other women, thought there was something wrong with me because I didn't have an orgasm waxing the kitchen floor. I was a freak writing that book. Not that I waxed any floor, I must admit, in the throes of finishing it in 1963. Each of us thought she was a freak 10 years ago if she didn't experience that mysterious orgastic fulfillment the commercials promised when waxing the kitchen floor. However much we enjoyed being Junior's and Janie's or Emily's mother or BJ's wife, if we still had ambitions, ideas about ourselves as people in our own right, well, we were simply freaks, neurotics. And we confessed our sin or neuroses to priest or psychoanalyst and tried hard to adjust. We didn't admit it to each other if we felt there should be more in life than peanut butter sandwiches with the kids, if throwing powder into the washing machine didn't make us relive our wedding night, if getting the socks or shirts pure white was not exactly a peak experience, even if we did feel guilty about the tattletale gray. Some of us, in 1963, nearly half of all women in the United States, were already committing the unpardonable sin of working outside the home to help pay the mortgage or grocery bill. Those who did felt guilty, too, about betraying their femininity, undermining their husband's masculinity, and neglecting their children by daring to work for money at all, no matter how much it was needed. They couldn't admit, even to themselves, that they resented being paid half what a man would have been paid for the job, or always being passed over for promotion, or writing the paper for which he got the degree and the raise. A suburban neighbor of mine named Gertie was having coffee with me when the census taker came as I was writing The Feminine Mystique. "Occupation?" the census taker asked. "Housewife," I said. Gertie, who had cheered me on in my efforts at writing and selling magazine articles, shook her head sadly. "You should take yourself more seriously," she said. I hesitated and then said to the census taker, "Actually, I'm a writer." But of course, I then was and still am, like all married women in America, no matter what else we do between 9 and 5, a housewife. Of course, single women didn't put down housewife when the census taker came around. But even here, society was less interested in what these women were doing as persons in the world than in asking, "Why isn't a nice girl like you married?" And so they, too, were not encouraged to take themselves seriously. It seemed such a precarious accident that I ever wrote the book at all. But, in another way, my whole life had prepared me to write that book. All the pieces finally came together. In 1957, getting strangely bored with writing articles about breastfeeding and the like for Red Book and the Ladies' Home Journal, I put an unconscionable amount of time into a questionnaire for my fellow Smith graduates of the class of 1942, thinking I was going to disprove the current notion that education had fitted us ill for our role as women. But the questionnaire raised more questions than it answered for me. Education had not exactly geared us to the role women were trying to play, it seemed. The suspicion arose as to whether it was the education or the role that was wrong. McCall's commissioned an article based on my Smith alumni questionnaire, but then the male publisher of McCall's, during that great era of togetherness, turned the piece down in horror, despite underground efforts of female editors. The male McCall's editors said it couldn't be true. I was next commissioned to do the article for Ladies' Home Journal. That time, I took it back, because they rewrote it to say just the opposite of what, in fact, I was trying to say. I tried it again for Red Book. Each time I was interviewing more women, psychologists, sociologists, marriage counselors, and the like, and getting more and more sure I was on the track of something. But what? I needed a name for whatever it was that kept us from using our rights, that made us feel guilty about anything we did, not as our husbands' wives, our children's mothers, but as people ourselves. I needed a name to describe that guilt. Unlike the guilt women used to feel about sexual needs, the guilt they felt now was about needs that didn't fit the sexual definition of women, the mystique of feminine fulfillment, the feminine mystique. The editor of Redbook told my agent, "Betty has gone off her rocker. She has always done a good job for us, but this time only the most neurotic housewife could identify." I opened my agent's letter on the subway as I was taking the kids to the pediatrician. I got off the subway to call my agent and told her, "I'll have to write a book to get this into print." What I was writing threatened the very foundations of the women's magazine world, the feminine mystique. When Norton contracted for the book, I thought it would take a year to finish it. It took 5. I wouldn't have even started it if the New York Public Library had not, at just the right time, opened the Frederick Lewis Allen room where writers working on a book could get a desk 6 months at a time, rent-free. I got a babysitter 3 days a week and took the bus from Rockland County to the city and somehow managed to prolong the 6 months to 2 years in the Allen room, enduring much joking from other writers at lunch when it came out that I was writing a book about women. Then, somehow, the book took me over, obsessed me, wanted to write itself, and I took my papers home and wrote on the dining room table, the living room couch, on a neighbor's dock on the river, and kept on writing it in my mind when I stopped to take the kids somewhere or make dinner and went back to it after they were in bed. I've never experienced anything as powerful, truly mystical, as the forces that seemed to take me over when I was writing The Feminine Mystique. The book came from somewhere deep within me, and all my experience came together in it. My mother's discontent, my own training in Gestalt and Freudian psychology, the fellowship I felt guilty about giving up, the stint as a reporter which taught me how to follow clues to the hidden economic underside of reality, my exodus to the suburbs, and all the hours with other mothers shopping at supermarkets, taking the children swimming, coffee clutches. Even the years of writing for women's magazines, when it was unquestioned gospel that women could identify with nothing beyond the home, not politics, not art, not science, not events large or small, war or peace, in the United States or the world, unless it could be approached through female experience as a wife or mother or translated into domestic detail. I could no longer write within that framework. The book I was now writing challenged the very definition of that universe, what I chose to call the feminine mystique. Giving it a name, I knew that it was not the only possible universe for women at all, but an unnatural confining of our energies and vision. But as I began following leads and clues from women's words and my own feelings across psychology, sociology, and recent history, tracing back through the pages of the magazines for which I'd written, why and how it happened, what it was really doing to women, to their children, even to sex, the implications became apparent, and they were fantastic. I was surprised myself at what I was writing, where it was leading. After I finished each chapter, a part of me would wonder, am I crazy? But there was also a growing feeling of calm, strong, gut sureness as the clues fitted together, which must be the same kind of feeling a scientist has when he or she zeroes in on a discovery in one of those true science detective stories. Only this was not just abstract and conceptual. It meant that I and every other woman I knew had been living a lie, and all the doctors who treated us and the experts who studied us were perpetuating that lie. And our homes and schools and churches and politics and professions were built around that lie. If women were really people, no more, no less, then all the things that kept them from being full people in our society would have to be changed. And women, once they broke through the feminine mystique and took themselves seriously as people, would see their place on a false pedestal, even their glorification as sexual objects, for the put-down it was. Yet if I had realized how fantastically fast that would really happen, already in less than 10 years' time, maybe I would have been so scared I might have stopped writing. It's frightening when you're starting on a new road that no one has been on before. You don't know how far it's going to take you until you look back and realize how far, how very far you've gone. When the first woman asked me in 1963 to autograph the feminine mystique, saying what, by now hundreds, thousands, I guess, of women have said to me, it changed my whole life, I wrote, courage to us all on the new road. Because there is no turning back on that road. It has to change your whole life. It certainly changed mine. Betty Friedan, New York, 1973. Chapter 1, The Problem That Has No Name. The problem lay buried, unspoken, for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night, she was afraid to ask even of herself the silent question, is this all? For over 15 years, there was no word of this yearning in the millions of words written about women, for women, in all the columns, books, and articles by experts telling women their role was to seek fulfillment as wives and mothers. Over and over, women heard in voices of tradition and of Freudian sophistication that they could desire no greater destiny than to glory in their own femininity. Experts told them how to catch a man and keep him, how to breastfeed children and handle their toilet training, how to cope with sibling rivalry and adolescent rebellion, how to buy a dishwasher, bake bread, cook gourmet snails, and build a swimming pool with their own hands, how to dress, look, and act more feminine, and make marriage more exciting, how to keep their husbands from dying young and their sons from growing into delinquents. They were taught to pity the neurotic, unfeminine, unhappy women who wanted to be poets or physicists or presidents. They learned that truly feminine women do not want careers, higher education, political rights, the independence and the opportunities that the old-fashioned feminists fought for. Some women in their 40s and 50s still remembered painfully giving up those dreams, but most of the younger women no longer even thought about them. 1,000 expert voices applauded their femininity, their adjustment, their new maturity. All they had to do was devote their lives from the earliest girlhood to finding a husband and bearing children. By the end of the 1950s, the average marriage age of women in America dropped to 20 and was still dropping into the teens. 14 million girls were engaged by 17. The proportion of women attending college in comparison with men dropped from 47% in 1920 to 35% in 1958. A century earlier, women had fought for higher education. Now girls went to college to get a husband. By the mid-50s, 60% dropped out of college to marry or because they were afraid too much education would be a marriage bar. Colleges built dormitories for married students, but the students were almost always the husbands. A new degree was instituted for the wives, PhD, putting husband through. Then American girls began getting married in high school, and the women's magazines, deploring the unhappy statistics about these young marriages, urged that courses on marriage and marriage counselors be installed in the high schools. Girls started going steady at 12 and 13 in junior high. Manufacturers put out brassieres with false bosoms of foam rubber for little girls of 10, and an advertisement for a child's dress, sizes 3 to 6X, in the New York Times in the fall of 1960 said, "She too can join the man trap set." By the end of the 50s, the United States birth rate was overtaking India's. The birth control movement, renamed Planned Parenthood, was asked to find a method whereby women who had been advised that a third or fourth baby would be born dead or defective might have it anyhow. Statisticians were especially astounded at the fantastic increase in the number of babies among college women. Where once they had 2 children, now they had 4, 5, 6. Women who had once wanted careers were now making careers out of having babies. So rejoiced Life magazine in a 1956 PN to the movement of American women back to the home. In a New York hospital, a woman had a nervous breakdown when she found she could not breastfeed her baby. In other hospitals, women dying of cancer refused a drug which research had proved might save their lives. Its side effects were said to be unfeminine. "If I have only one life, let me live it as a blonde," a larger-than-life-sized picture of a pretty, vacuous woman proclaimed from newspaper, magazine, and drugstore ads. And across America, 3 out of every 10 women dyed their hair blonde. They ate a chalk called Metrical instead of food to shrink to the size of the thin young models. Department store buyers reported that American women, since 1939, had become 3 and 4 sizes smaller. "Women are out to fit the clothes instead of vice versa," one buyer said. Interior decorators were designing kitchens with mosaic murals and original paintings, for kitchens were once again the center of women's lives. Home sewing became a million-dollar industry. Many women no longer left their homes except to shop, chauffeur their children, or attend a social engagement with their husbands. Girls were growing up in America without ever having jobs outside the home. In the late 50s, a sociological phenomenon was suddenly remarked. A third of American women now worked, but most were no longer young and very few were pursuing careers. They were married women who held part-time jobs, selling or secretarial, to put their husbands through school, their sons through college, or to help pay the mortgage. Or they were widows supporting families. Fewer and fewer women were entering professional work. The shortages in the nursing, social work, and teaching professions caused crises in almost every American city. Concerned over the Soviet Union's lead in the space race, scientists noted that Americans' greatest source of unused brain power was women. But girls would not study physics. It was unfeminine. A girl refused a science fellowship at Johns Hopkins to take a job in a real estate office. All she wanted, she said, was what every other American girl wanted: to get married, have 4 children, and live in a nice house in a nice suburb. The suburban housewife. She was the dream image of the young American woman and the envy, it was said, of women all over the world. The American housewife, freed by science and labor-saving appliances from the drudgery, the dangers of childbirth, and the illnesses of her grandmother. She was healthy, beautiful, educated, concerned only about her husband, her children, her home. She had found true feminine fulfillment. As a housewife and mother, she was respected as a full and equal partner to man in his world. She was free to choose automobiles, clothes, appliances, supermarkets. She had everything that women ever dreamed of. In the 15 years after World War II, this mystique of feminine fulfillment became the cherished and self-perpetuating core of contemporary American culture. Millions of women lived their lives in the image of those pretty pictures of the American suburban housewife, kissing their husbands goodbye in front of the picture window, depositing their station wagons full of children at school, and smiling as they ran the new electric waxer over the spotless kitchen floor. They baked their own bread, sewed their own and their children's clothes, kept their new washing machines and dryers running all day. They changed the sheets on the beds 2 times a week instead of once, took the rug hooking class in adult education, and pitied the poor frustrated mothers who had dreamed of having a career. Their only dream was to be perfect wives and mothers. Their highest ambition, to have 5 children and a beautiful house. Their only fight, to get and keep their husbands. They had no thought for the unfeminine problems of the world outside the home. They wanted the men to make the major decisions. They gloried in their role as women and wrote proudly on the census blank, occupation, housewife. For over 15 years, the words written for women and the words women used when they talked to each other while their husbands sat on the other side of the room and talked shop or politics or septic tanks were about problems with their children or how to keep their husbands happy or improve their children's school or cook chicken or make slipcovers. Nobody argued whether women were inferior or superior to men. They were simply different. Words like emancipation and career sounded strange and embarrassing. No one had used them for years. When a French woman named Simone de Beauvoir wrote a book called The Second Sex, an American critic commented that she obviously didn't know what life was all about. And besides, she was talking about French women. The woman problem in America no longer existed. If a woman had a problem in the 1950s and 1960s, she knew that something must be wrong with her marriage or with herself. Other women were satisfied with their lives, she thought. What kind of a woman was she if she did not feel this mysterious fulfillment waxing the kitchen floor? She was so ashamed to admit her dissatisfaction that she never knew how many other women shared it. If she tried to tell her husband, he didn't understand what she was talking about. She did not really understand it herself. For over 15 years, women in America found it harder to talk about this problem than about sex. Even the psychoanalysts had no name for it. When a woman went to a psychiatrist for help, as many women did, she would say, "I'm so ashamed," or, "I must be hopelessly neurotic." "I don't know what's wrong with women today," the suburban psychiatrist said uneasily. "I only know something is wrong because most of my patients happen to be women, and their problem isn't sexual." Most women with this problem did not go see a psychoanalyst, however. "There's nothing wrong, really," they kept telling themselves. "There isn't any problem." But on an April morning in 1959, I heard a mother of four having coffee with four other mothers in a suburban development 15 miles from New York say in a tone of quiet desperation, "The problem." And the others knew, without words, that she was not talking about a problem with her husband or her children or her home. Suddenly they realized they all shared the same problem, the problem that has no name. They began, hesitantly, to talk about it. Later, after they had picked up their children at nursery school and taken them home to nap, two of the women cried in sheer relief, just to know they were not alone. Gradually, I came to realize that the problem that has no name was shared by countless women in America. As a magazine writer, I often interviewed women about problems with their children or their marriages or their houses or their communities. But after a while, I began to recognize the telltale signs of this other problem. I saw the same signs in suburban ranch houses and split levels on Long Island and in New Jersey and Westchester County, in colonial houses in a small Massachusetts town, on patios in Memphis, in suburban and city apartments, in living rooms in the Midwest. Sometimes I sensed the problem, not as a reporter, but as a suburban housewife, for during this time I was also bringing up my own three children in Rockland County, New York. I heard echoes of the problem in college dormitories and semi-private maternity wards, at PTA meetings and luncheons of the League of Women Voters, at suburban cocktail parties and station wagons waiting for trains, and in snatches of conversation overheard at Schraff's. The groping words I heard from other women on quiet afternoons when children were at school or on quiet evenings when husbands worked late, I think I understood first as a woman long before I understood their larger social and psychological implications. Just what was this problem that has no name? What were the words women used when they tried to express it? Sometimes a woman would say, "I feel empty somehow, incomplete." Or she would say, "I feel as if I don't exist." Sometimes she blotted out the feeling with a tranquilizer, Sometimes she thought the problem was with her husband or her children, or that what she really needed was to redecorate her house or move to a better neighborhood or have an affair or another baby. Sometimes she went to a doctor with symptoms she could hardly describe. A tired feeling. I get so angry with the children. It scares me. I feel like crying without any reason. A Cleveland doctor called it the housewife syndrome. A number of women told me about great bleeding blisters that break out on their hands and arms. I call it the housewife's blight, said a family doctor in Pennsylvania. I see it so often lately in these young women with 4, 5, and 6 children who bury themselves in their dishpans. But it isn't caused by detergent, and it isn't cured by cortisone. Sometimes a woman would tell me that the feeling gets so strong she runs out of the house and walks through the streets. Or she stays inside her house and cries. Or her children tell her a joke, and she doesn't laugh because she doesn't hear it. I talked to women who had spent years on the analyst couch working out their adjustment to the feminine role, their blocks to fulfillment as a wife and mother. But the desperate tone in these women's voices and the look in their eyes was the same as the tone and the look of other women who were sure they had no problem, even though they did have a strange feeling of desperation. A mother of 4 who left college at 19 to get married told me, I've tried everything women are supposed to do, hobbies, gardening, pickling, canning, being very social with my neighbors, joining committees, running PTATs. I can do it all and I like it, but it doesn't leave you anything to think about, any feeling of who you are. I never had any career ambitions. All I wanted was to get married and have 4 children. I love the kids and Bob and my home. There's no problem you can even put a name to, but I'm desperate. I begin to feel I have no personality. I'm a server of food and a putter-on of pants and a bedmaker, somebody who can be called on when you want something. But who am I? A 23-year-old mother in blue jeans said, I ask myself why I'm so dissatisfied. I've got my health, fine children, a lovely new home, enough money. My husband has a real future as an electronics engineer. He doesn't have any of these feelings. He says maybe I need a vacation. Let's go to New York for a weekend. But that isn't it. I always had this idea we should do everything together. I can't sit down and read a book alone. If the children are napping and I have 1 hour to myself, I just walk through the house waiting for them to wake up. I don't make a move until I know where the rest of the crowd is going. It's as if, ever since you were a little girl, there's always been somebody or something that will take care of your life. Your parents or college or falling in love or having a child or moving to a new house. Then you wake up one morning and there's nothing to look forward to. A young wife in a Long Island development said, I seem to sleep so much. I don't know why I should be so tired. This house isn't nearly so hard to clean as the cold water flat we had when I was working. The children are at school all day. It's not the work. I just don't feel alive. In 1960, the problem that has no name burst like a boil through the image of the happy American housewife. In the television commercials, the pretty housewives still beamed over their foaming dishpans, and Time's cover story on The Suburban Wife, an American Phenomenon, protested, having too good a time to believe that they should be unhappy. But the actual unhappiness of the American housewife was suddenly being reported. From the New York Times and Newsweek to Good Housekeeping, and CBS Television, The Trapped Housewife. Although almost everybody who talked about it found some superficial reason to dismiss it. It was attributed to incompetent appliance repairmen, New York Times, or the distances children must be chauffeured in the suburbs, Time, or too much PTA, Red Book. Some said it was the old problem, education. More and more women had education, which naturally made them unhappy in their role as housewives. The road from Freud to Frigidaire, from Sophocles to Spock, has turned out to be a bumpy one, reported the New York Times, June 28, 1960. Many young women, certainly not all, whose education plunged them into a world of ideas, feel stifled in their homes. They find their routine lives out of joint with their training. Like shut-ins, they feel left out. In the last year, the problem of the educated housewife has provided the meat of dozens of speeches made by troubled presidents of women's colleges who maintain, in the face of complaints, that 16 years of academic training is realistic preparation for wifehood and motherhood. There was much sympathy for the educated housewife. Like a two-headed schizophrenic, once she wrote a paper on graveyard poets, now she writes notes to the milkman. Once she determined the boiling point of sulfuric acid, now she determines her boiling point with the overdue repairman. The housewife often is reduced to screams and tears. No one, it seems, is appreciative, least of all herself, of the kind of person she becomes in the process of turning from poetess into shrew. Home economists suggested more realistic preparation for housewives, such as high school workshops in home appliances. College educators suggested more discussion groups on home management and the family to prepare women for the adjustment to domestic life. A spate of articles appeared in the mass magazines offering 58 ways to make your marriage more exciting. No month went by without a new book by a psychiatrist or sexologist offering technical advice on finding greater fulfillment through sex. A male humorist joked in Harper's Bazaar, July 1960, that the problem could be solved by taking away woman's right to vote. In the pre-19th Amendment era, the American woman was placid, sheltered, and sure of her role in American society. She left all the political decisions to her husband, and he, in turn, left all the family decisions to her. Today, a woman has to make both the family and the political decisions, and it's too much for her. A number of educators suggested, seriously, that women no longer be admitted to the four-year colleges and universities. In the growing college crisis, the education which girls could not use as housewives was more urgently needed than ever by boys to do the work of the atomic age. The problem was also dismissed with drastic solutions no one could take seriously. A woman writer proposed in Harper's that women be drafted for compulsory service as nurses, aides, and babysitters. And it was smoothed over with the age-old panaceas, love is their answer. The only answer is inner help, the secret of completeness, children, a private means of intellectual fulfillment. To cure this toothache of the spirit, the simple formula of handing oneself and one's will over to God. The problem was dismissed by telling the housewife she doesn't realize how lucky she is. Her own boss, no time clock, no junior executive gunning for her job. What if she isn't happy? Does she think men are happy in this world? Does she really secretly still want to be a man? Doesn't she know yet how lucky she is to be a woman? The problem was also, and finally, dismissed by shrugging that there are no solutions. This is what being a woman means, and what is wrong with American women that they can't accept their role gracefully? As Newsweek put it, March 7, 1960, she is dissatisfied with a lot that women of other lands can only dream of. Her discontent is deep, pervasive, and impervious to the superficial remedies which are offered at every hand. An army of professional explorers have already charted the major sources of trouble. From the beginning of time, the female cycle has defined and confined woman's role. As Freud was credited with saying, anatomy is destiny. Though no group of women has ever pushed these natural restrictions as far as the American wife, it seems that she still cannot accept them with good grace. A young mother with a beautiful family, charm, talent, and brains is apt to dismiss her role apologetically. What do I do? You hear her say. Why, nothing. I'm just a housewife. A good education, it seems, has given this paragon among women an understanding of the value of everything, except her own worth. And so she must accept the fact that American women's unhappiness is merely the most recently won of women's rights, and adjust and say, with the happy housewife found by Newsweek, We ought to salute the wonderful freedom we all have and be proud of our lives today. I have had college, and I have worked, but being a housewife is the most rewarding and satisfying role. My mother was never included in my father's business affairs. She couldn't get out of the house and away from us children, but I am an equal to my husband. I can go along with him on business trips and to social business affairs. The alternative offered was a choice that few women would contemplate. In the sympathetic words of the New York Times, "I'll admit to being deeply frustrated at times by the lack of privacy, the physical burden, the routine of family life, the confinement of it. However, none would give up her home and family if she had the choice to make again." Redbook commented, "Few women would want to thumb their noses at husbands, children, and community and go off on their own. Those who do may be talented individuals, but they rarely are successful women." The year American women's discontent boiled over, it was also reported, Look magazine, that the more than 21 million American women who are single, widowed, or divorced do not cease even after 50 their frenzied, desperate search for a man. And the search begins early, for 70% of all American women now marry before they are 24. A pretty 25-year-old secretary took 35 different jobs in 6 months in the futile hope of finding a husband. Women were moving from one political club to another, taking evening courses in accounting or sailing, learning to play golf or ski, joining a number of churches in succession, going to bars alone in their ceaseless search for a man. Of the growing thousands of women currently getting private psychiatric help in the United States, the married ones were reported dissatisfied with their marriages, the unmarried ones suffering from anxiety and, finally, depression. Strangely, a number of psychiatrists stated that, in their experience, unmarried women patients were happier than married ones. So the door of all those pretty suburban houses opened a crack to permit a glimpse of uncounted thousands of American housewives who suffered alone from a problem that suddenly everyone was talking about and beginning to take for granted as one of those unreal problems in American life that can never be solved, like the hydrogen bomb. By 1962, the plight of the trapped American housewife had become a national parlor game. Whole issues of magazines, newspaper columns, books learned and frivolous, educational conferences, and television panels were devoted to the problem. Even so, most men and some women still did not know that this problem was real. But those who had faced it honestly knew that all the superficial remedies, the sympathetic advice, the scolding words and the cheering words were somehow drowning the problem in unreality. A bitter laugh was beginning to be heard from American women. They were admired, envied, pitied, theorized over until they were sick of it, offered drastic solutions or silly choices that no one could take seriously. They got all kinds of advice from the growing armies of marriage and child guidance counselors, psychotherapists, and armchair psychologists on how to adjust to their role as housewives. No other road to fulfillment was offered to American women in the middle of the 20th century. Most adjusted to their role and suffered or ignored the problem that has no name. It can be less painful for a woman not to hear the strange, dissatisfied voice stirring within her. It is no longer possible to ignore that voice, to dismiss the desperation of so many American women. This is not what being a woman means, no matter what the experts say. For human suffering, there is a reason. Perhaps the reason has not been found because the right questions have not been asked or pressed far enough. I do not accept the answer that there is no problem because American women have luxuries that women in other times and lands never dreamed of. Part of the strange newness of the problem is that it cannot be understood in terms of the age-old material problems of man: poverty, sickness, hunger, cold. The women who suffer this problem have a hunger that food cannot fill. It persists in women whose husbands are struggling interns and law clerks, or prosperous doctors and lawyers, and wives of workers and executives who make $5,000 a year or $50,000. It is not caused by lack of material advantages, it may not even be felt by women preoccupied with desperate problems of hunger, poverty, or illness. And women who think it will be solved by more money, a bigger house, a second car, moving to a better suburb, often discover it gets worse. It is no longer possible today to blame the problem on loss of femininity. To say that education and independence and equality with men have made American women unfeminine. I have heard so many women try to deny this dissatisfied voice within themselves because it does not fit the pretty picture of femininity the experts have given them. I think, in fact, that this is the first clue to the mystery. The problem cannot be understood in the generally accepted terms by which scientists have studied women, doctors have treated them, counselors have advised them, and writers have written about them. Women who suffer this problem, in whom this voice is stirring, have lived their whole lives in the pursuit of feminine fulfillment. They are not career women, although career women may have other problems. They are women whose greatest ambition has been marriage and children. For the oldest of these women, these daughters of the American middle class, no other dream was possible. The ones in their 40s and 50s who once had other dreams gave them up and threw themselves joyously into life as housewives. For the youngest, the new wives and mothers, this was the only dream. They are the ones who quit high school and college to marry, or mark time in some job in which they had no real interest until they married. These women are very feminine in the usual sense, and yet they still suffer the problem. Are the women who finish college, the women who once had dreams beyond housewifery, the ones who suffer the most? According to the experts, they are, but listen to these four women. My days are all busy and dull, too. All I ever do is mess around. I get up at 8, I make breakfast, so I do the dishes, have lunch, do some more dishes, and some laundry, and cleaning in the afternoon. Then it's supper dishes, and I get to sit down a few minutes before the children have to be sent to bed. That's all there is to my day. It's just like any other wife's day. Humdrum. The biggest time, I am chasing kids. Ye gods, what do I do with my time? Well, I get up at 6, I get my son dressed and then give him breakfast. After that, I wash dishes and bathe and feed the baby. Then I get lunch, and while the children nap, I sew or mend or iron and do all the other things I can't get done before noon. Then I cook supper for the family, and my husband watches TV while I do the dishes. And I get the children to bed, I set my hair, and then I go to bed. The problem is always being the children's mommy or the minister's wife and never being myself. A film made of any typical morning in my house would look like an old Marx Brothers comedy. I wash the dishes, rush the older children off to school, dash out in the yard to cultivate the chrysanthemums, run back in to make a phone call about a committee meeting, help the youngest child build a blockhouse, spend 15 minutes skimming the newspaper so I can be well informed, then scamper down to the washing machines where my thrice weekly laundry includes enough clothes to keep a primitive village going for an entire year. By noon, I'm ready for a padded cell. Very little of what I've done has been really necessary or important. Outside pressures lash me through the day. Yet I look upon myself as one of the more relaxed housewives in the neighborhood. Many of my friends are even more frantic. In the past 60 years, we have come full circle, and the American housewife is once again trapped in a squirrel cage. If the cage is now a modern plate glass and broadloom ranch house or a convenient modern apartment, the situation is no less painful than when her grandmother sat over an embroidery hoop in her gilt and plush parlor and muttered angrily about women's rights. The first two women never went to college. They lived in developments in Levittown, New Jersey, and Tacoma, Washington, and were interviewed by a team of sociologists studying working men's wives. The third, a minister's wife, wrote on the 15th reunion questionnaire of her college that she never had any career ambitions, but wishes now she had. The fourth, who has a PhD in anthropology, is today a Nebraska housewife with three children. Their words seem to indicate that housewives of all educational levels suffer the same feeling of desperation. The fact is that no one today is muttering angrily about women's rights, even though more and more women have gone to college. In a recent study of all the classes that have graduated from Barnard College, a significant minority of earlier graduates blame their education for making them want rights. Later classes blame their education for giving them career dreams. But recent graduates blamed the college for making them feel it was not enough simply to be a housewife and mother. They did not want to feel guilty if they did not read books or take part in community activities. But if education is not the cause of the problem, the fact that education somehow festers in these women may be a clue. If the secret of feminine fulfillment is having children, never have so many women, with the freedom to choose, had so many children in so few years, so willingly. If the answer is love, never have women searched for love with such determination. And yet there is a growing suspicion that the problem may not be sexual, though it must somehow be related to sex. I have heard from many doctors evidence of new sexual problems between man and wife. Sexual hunger in wives so great their husbands cannot satisfy it. "We have made woman a sex creature," said a psychiatrist at the Margaret Sanger Marriage Counseling Clinic. "She has no identity except as a wife and mother. She does not know who she is herself. She waits all day for her husband to come home at night to make her feel alive. And now it is the husband who is not interested. It is terrible for the women to lie there night after night, waiting for her husband to make her feel alive." Why is there such a market for books and articles offering sexual advice? The kind of sexual orgasm which Kinsey found in statistical plenitude in the recent generations of American women does not seem to make this problem go away. On the contrary, new neuroses are being seen among women, and problems as yet unnamed as neuroses, which Freud and his followers did not predict, with physical symptoms, anxieties, and defense mechanisms equal to those caused by sexual repression. And strange new problems are being reported in the growing generations of children whose mothers were always there, driving them around, helping them with their homework, an inability to endure pain or discipline or pursue any self-sustained goal of any sort, a devastating boredom with life. Educators are increasingly uneasy about the dependence, the lack of self-reliance of the boys and girls who are entering college today. "We fight a continual battle to make our students assume manhood," said a Columbia dean. A White House conference was held on the physical and muscular deterioration of American children. Were they being overnurtured? Sociologists noted the astounding organization of suburban children's lives, the lessons, parties, entertainments, play and study groups organized for them. A suburban housewife in Portland, Oregon, wondered why the children need brownies and Boy Scouts out here. "This is not the slums. The kids out here have the great outdoors. I think people are so bored they organize the children and then try to hook everyone else on it. And the poor kids have no time left just to lie on their beds and daydream." Can the problem that has no name be somehow related to the domestic routine of the housewife? When a woman tries to put the problem into words, she often merely describes the daily life she leads. What is there in this recital of comfortable domestic detail that could possibly cause such a feeling of desperation? Is she trapped simply by the enormous demands of her role as modern housewife? Wife, mistress, mother, nurse, consumer, cook, chauffeur. Expert on interior decoration, childcare, appliance repair, furniture refinishing, nutrition, and education. Her day is fragmented as she rushes from dishwasher to washing machine to telephone to dryer to station wagon to supermarket and delivers Johnny to the Little League field, takes Janie to dancing class, gets the lawnmower fixed and meets the 6:45. She can never spend more than 15 minutes on any one thing. She has no time to read books, only magazines. Even if she had time, she has lost the power to concentrate. At the end of the day, she is so terribly tired that sometimes her husband has to take over and put the children to bed. This terrible tiredness took so many women to doctors in the 1950s that one decided to investigate it. He found, surprisingly, that his patients suffering from housewife's fatigue slept more than an adult needed to sleep, as much as 10 hours a day, and that the actual energy they expended on housework, did not tax their capacity. The real problem must be something else, he decided. Perhaps boredom. Some doctors told their women patients they must get out of the house for a day, treat themselves to a movie in town. Others prescribed tranquilizers. Many suburban housewives were taking tranquilizers like cough drops. You wake up in the morning and you feel as if there's no point in going on another day like this, so you take a tranquilizer because it makes you not care so much that it's pointless. It is easy to see the concrete details that trap the suburban housewife, the continual demands on her time. But the chains that bind her in her trap are chains in her own mind and spirit. They are chains made up of mistaken ideas and misinterpreted facts, of incomplete truths and unreal choices. They are not easily seen and not easily shaken off. How can any woman see the whole truth within the bounds of her own life? How can she believe that voice inside herself when it denies the conventional accepted truths by which she has been living? And yet the women I have talked to, who are finally listening to that inner voice, seem in some incredible way to be groping through to a truth that has defied the experts. I think the experts, in a great many fields, have been holding pieces of that truth under their microscopes for a long time without realizing it. I found pieces of it in certain new research and theoretical developments in psychological, social, and biological science whose implications for women seem never to have been examined. I found many clues by talking to suburban doctors, gynecologists, obstetricians, child guidance clinicians, pediatricians, high school guidance counselors, college professors, marriage counselors, psychiatrists, and ministers, questioning them not on their theories, but on their actual experience in treating American women. I became aware of a growing body of evidence, much of which has not been reported publicly because it does not fit current modes of thought about women. Evidence which throws into question the standards of feminine normality, feminine adjustment, feminine fulfillment, and feminine maturity by which most women are still trying to live. I began to see in a strange new light the American return to early marriage and the large families that are causing the population explosion, the recent movement to natural childbirth and breastfeeding, suburban conformity and the new neurosis, character pathologies, and sexual problems being reported by the doctors. I began to see new dimensions to old problems that have long been taken for granted among women. Menstrual difficulties, sexual frigidity, promiscuity, pregnancy fears, childbirth depression, the high incidence of emotional breakdown and suicide among women in their 20s and 30s, the menopause crisis, the so-called passivity and immaturity of American men, the discrepancy between women's tested intellectual abilities in childhood and their adult achievement, the changing incidence of adult sexual orgasm in American women, and persistent problems in psychotherapy and in women's education. If I am right, the problem that has no name stirring in the minds of so many American women today is not a matter of loss of femininity or too much education or the demands of domesticity. It is far more important than anyone recognizes. It is the key to these other new and old problems which have been torturing women and their husbands and children and puzzling their doctors and educators for years. It may well be the key to our future as a nation and a culture. We can no longer ignore that voice within women that says, I want something more than my husband and my children and my home. Chapter 2. The Happy Housewife Heroine. Why have so many American wives suffered this nameless aching dissatisfaction for so many years, each one thinking she was alone? I've got tears in my eyes with sheer relief that my own inner turmoil is shared with other women, a young Connecticut mother wrote me when I first began to put this problem into words. A woman from a town in Ohio wrote, the times when I felt that the only answer was to consult a psychiatrist, times of anger, bitterness, and general frustration, too numerous to even mention, I had no idea that hundreds of other women were feeling the same way. I felt so completely alone. A Houston, Texas housewife wrote, it has been the feeling of being almost alone with my problem that has made it so hard. I thank God for my family, home, and the chance to care for them, but my life couldn't stop there. It is an awakening to know that I'm not an oddity and can stop being ashamed of wanting something more. That painful, guilty silence and that tremendous relief when a feeling is finally out in the open are familiar psychological signs. What need, what part of themselves could so many women today be repressing? In this age after Freud, sex is immediately suspect, but this new stirring in women does not seem to be sex. It is, in fact, much harder for women to talk about than sex. Could there be another need, a part of themselves they have buried as deeply as the Victorian women buried sex? If there is, a woman might not know what it was any more than the Victorian woman knew she had sexual needs. The image of a good woman by which Victorian ladies lived simply left out sex. Does the image by which modern American women live also leave something out? The proud and public image of the high school girl going steady, the college girl in love, the suburban housewife with an up-and-coming husband and a station wagon full of children? This image, created by the women's magazines, by advertisements, television, movies, novels, columns, and books by experts on marriage and the family, child psychology, sexual adjustment, and by the popularizers of sociology and psychoanalysis, shapes women's lives today and mirrors their dreams. It may give a clue to the problem that has no name, as a dream gives a clue to a wish unnamed by the dreamer. In the mind's ear, a Geiger counter clicks when the image shows too sharp a discrepancy from reality. A Geiger counter clicked in my own inner ear when I could not fit the quiet desperation of so many women into the picture of the modern American housewife that I myself was helping to create, writing for the women's magazines. What is missing from the image which shapes the American woman's pursuit of fulfillment as a wife and mother? What is missing from the image that mirrors and creates the identity of women in America today? In the early 1960s, McCall's has been the fastest growing of the women's magazines. Its contents are a fairly accurate representation of the image of the American woman presented and in part created by the large circulation magazines. Here are the complete editorial contents of a typical issue of McCall's, July 1960. Number 1. A lead article on increasing baldness in women, caused by too much brushing and dyeing. Number 2. A long poem in primer-sized type about a child called A Boy is a Boy. Number 3. A short story about how a teenager who doesn't go to college gets a man away from a bright college girl. Number 4. A short story about the minute sensations of a baby throwing his bottle out of the crib. Number 5. The first of a two-part intimate, up-to-date account by the Duke of Windsor on how the Duchess and I now live and spend our time, the influence of clothes on me and vice versa. Number 6. A short story about a 19-year-old girl sent to a charm school to learn how to bat her eyelashes and lose at tennis. You're 19, and by normal American standards, I am now entitled to have you taken off my hands, legally and financially, by some beardless youth who will spirit you away to a one-and-a-half-room apartment in the village while he learns the chicanery of selling bonds. And no beardless youth is going to do that as long as you volley to his backhand. Number 7. The story of a honeymoon couple commuting between separate bedrooms after an argument over gambling at Las Vegas. Number 8. An article on how to overcome an inferiority complex. Number 9. A story called Wedding Day. Number 10. The story of a teenager's mother who learns how to dance rock and roll. Number 11. 6 pages of glamorous pictures of models in maternity clothes. Number 12. 4 glamorous pages on Reduce the Way the Models Do. Number 13. An article on airline delays. Number 14. Patterns for home sewing. Number 15, patterns with which to make folding screens, bewitching magic. Number 16, an article called An Encyclopedic Approach to Finding a Second Husband. Number 17, a barbecue bonanza dedicated to the great American mister who stands, chef's cap on head, fork in hand, on terrace or back porch, in patio, or backyard anywhere in the land, watching his roast turning on the spit, and to his wife, without whom, sometimes, the barbecue can never be the smashing summer success it undoubtedly is. There were also the regular front-of-the-book service columns on new drug and medicine developments, child care facts, columns by Claire Luce and by Eleanor Roosevelt, and Pats and Pans, a column of readers' letters. The image of woman that emerges from this big, pretty magazine is young and frivolous,